on the incidence of teenage pregnancies in South Africa. I thought it would be important to take this briefing, given that it was issued on Friday. But I also thought it was important that we get the heavyweights in this committee to chair this session, simply because I think it needs a principal's touch. So that what we will do is Ms. Gina will be chairing the session. We'll take the briefing initially, and then we will open up for discussion. Okay. So members, I'm not sure how this is going to work, because maybe Ms. Gina should be going over there to chair so that you can have a look at the members. Now then you won't be able to see on the screen. So maybe Ms. Gina, you should be sitting there so that you can see the members when they're putting up their hands and so on. Otherwise it's going to be very, very awkward. I'm handing over to you immediately. Thereafter, members will try and go through the draft report of our trip. You'll recall we did a first draft a while ago. I think this is now the third draft that we've got in front of us. I had a look at the second draft, made some further changes, and Mr. Bundy and Mr. Brown have, or is it Mr. Bundy by himself, has corrected those things, and so we'll go through it with whatever time we have left in the session. If we don't have enough time, we'll just carry that issue or that item over. Okay. Over to you, Principal Gina.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. In this committee today, we are joined by the members of a committee from women, I think I'll call it WEN. It's Women, Children, and Youth People with Disability. Or Persons with Disability. Yeah, that is why I wanted you to correct me so that I can pronounce it well. So thank you very much for that committee to be with us here. We want to introduce that committee to the Department of Education because we believe they are the ones that are very much interested on this issue around teenage pregnancy, and they've got so much to contribute in the presentation that you are going to give us today. So let us not waste time. Can I just give this chance to the Department of Education to start presenting the report, the findings that they have around the teenage pregnancy in school learning children. Thank you very much. Over to you, Department.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. My name is Gugu Ndebele. I'm the Deputy Director General responsible for social and school enrichment programs in the Department of Education. Firstly, let me apologize on behalf of our Director General. We have a meeting of the heads of departments from all the provinces, which he chairs in Bloemfontein, and he's therefore not able to be here. But he did ask me to convey his apologies. I wish to start by thanking the committee for inviting us so soon after the release of the report, because I think it's important that the committee listens to the report before different versions emerge out there. But secondly, because we using the presentations of the report also to get feedback on the kind of strategy that we could put in place to deal with the matter. So we appreciate that we will have an opportunity to listen to some of the suggestions from the honorable members about the emerging strategy that needs to be in place. I also wish to thank the committee for inviting the committee members from the Women, Children and Persons with Disability Committee, because again, we, as you will see in our presentation, we plan to have one-on-one conversations with that ministry and department so that we start establishing the synergies. We're going to have, the presentation is going to be in two parts, Chairperson. The first part is the research findings themselves, which Dr. Pandey will present. And then once after we've had the discussion, we'd just like to appraise the committee on the proposed way forward from the department on the report. I'm here with my team. We have the Chief Director for Equity and Education, Thandi Lewin, who's sitting on my right. I have Dr. Pandey on my left, who incidentally has just started in the department, but she's one of the researchers, so she's wearing the researcher hat today, but she's now the director in the Department for Health and Education. And to my extreme right is our director for gender equity, Ms. Lady Mabunda. Just for the record, to indicate that we as a department commissioned the report because there were so many incidents that were being reported in the newspapers, but there was clearly no coherent research or bringing together of research that had been done. And we felt that instead of designing strategies out of the blue, we needed to have evidence-based approach to the strategies. And we asked the HSRC to therefore conduct a study on us to review existing literature, because there is existing literature, to establish the prevalence and determinants of teenage pregnancy. But not just to end it, to also help us identify and assess some of the impacts of the existing interventions that are currently out there, but to also propose a conceptual framework from which we could work. As the chairperson had indicated, the report was released on Friday, and we had a seminar which we'll talk about, and we reported to our Council of Education Ministers, and they've made comments. We're here now to report to the honorable members to present the report. I'll hand over to Dr. Pandey to do the presentation.
Thanks, VDG. Good morning, honorable members. I want to begin the presentation by acknowledging our partners on the project, the Department of Education, UNICEF, and the Human Sciences Research Council. I also wish to acknowledge the co-authors on the report, Dr. Mondi Makiwane, Chitra Ranchor, and Thabo Leswalo from the HSRC. Now, the report is quite expansive at 155 pages, and it would be impossible for me to cover the range and depth of the issues in 30 to 45 minutes. But what I will do is highlight some of the key issues in broad brushstrokes that would allow for a robust discussion around this issue. By way of outline of the presentation, I'll give a brief background to the study, outline the methods that we used to compile the report. I'll then talk about trends in fertility and comment on the analysis of the education management information system data. I'll then focus on the conceptual framework that we used for the study, highlight important determinants of teenage fertility in South Africa, outline some key principles for intervention development, and then make key recommendations for interventions in our context. And I'll draw my section of the presentation to a close by reminding us of some of the key take-home messages from the report, and then I'll hand over to Shleki. Now, in recent years, there's been increasing levels of concern in both research and policy circles about high and, in some cases, rising levels of teen fertility in South Africa. However, as this presentation will outline, available evidence suggests that it is an area in which substantial progress has been made since the advent of democracy. And yet, even in the face of this available evidence that has been in the public domain for some time, concerns about rising teen fertility persist. Now, it is well known that aspirations for education are high in South Africa and that young people see the value of education in their lives. And as such, with increasing opportunities for education, young people are spending longer and longer periods of time to acquire the requisite levels of education. As part of the normal course of development, it is therefore natural that sexual development will coincide with education. For most, it will be at the level of experimentation. But for some, it will result in unintended pregnancies, HIV, and other negative reproductive health outcomes. And the education system has responded by using a rights-based framework even before the transition to democracy. South Africa instituted a very progressive policy towards learner pregnancies by allowing girls to remain in school while pregnant and to return to school post-pregnancy. Now, this practice has protected young women's educational outcomes and helped delay second birth. In fact, what we see in South Africa is a bimodal pattern of fertility, with early first birth in the teen years, followed by a delay in second birth until the late 20s. So when we ask young women why is it that they delay second birth, they tell us that they want to continue their education. So aspirations for education are extremely high in South Africa. In response to recent concerns about rising levels of learner pregnancy, in 2007, the Department of Education introduced guidelines to prevent and manage learner pregnancies in the school context. But the introduction of policy and practice, and in particular any shift in policy and practice, must be supported by a thorough assessment and understanding of the context of the issue, in this case, teenage pregnancy, hence this report. The Department of Education, through the support of UNICEF, commissioned the Human Sciences Research Council to document, analyze, and critically appraise data on teenage pregnancy with a specific focus on learner pregnancy. We did this using two principal methods: a review of available literature between 2000 and 2008, and secondary analysis of two key data sets. Pertaining to the literature review, while the country has produced a number of descriptive studies on teenage pregnancy in the early 1990s, limited data was available post-2000. Now, in many respects, pregnancy has been overtaken by HIV as a primary reproductive health concern for young people. However, because pregnancy and HIV share many common antecedents, chief amongst which is unprotected sex, we were able to draw on this rich store of data to inform the development of this report. We drew principally on three national surveys, although there's quite an extensive reference list for the report. These are the 2003 Reproductive Health Research Unit Survey, conducted amongst 15 to 24-year-olds, the 2006 Kaiser study that also was conducted in the same age group, and two rounds of the HSRC HIV Household Survey. With respect to trends in fertility, there are issues around the accuracy and reliability of data sets, and I'll talk more about that a little later on. What we did was draw on a number of sources to provide an overall and composite picture of teen fertility in the country. These sources include the 1996 and 2001 census data, the 1998 South African Demographic and Health Survey. We've touched briefly on the 2007 Community Survey. We could not use the 2003 SADHS because of problems with the fieldwork that compromised the reliability of the data set. We also drew on a number of demographic surveillance sites in South Africa that have collected data on fertility over several years. This has assisted us in verifying the trends observed through national data sets. With respect to the secondary analysis, the Education Management Information System collects data on learner pregnancies in schools. Now, there are some limitations to this data, and I'll discuss it later on. We analyzed this data for 2004 to 2008 to identify trends in fertility. We also used a number of variables, such as the fee status of the school, the type of school, the land ownership of the school, to indicate the types of schools in which learner pregnancies may be concentrating. We also analyzed the 2003 HSRC Status of Youth Survey that was conducted among 3,500 young people aged 18 to 35 years. Now, the advantage of this data set is that we could tease apart which came first. Was it pregnancy or early exit from the schooling system? Now, this is a point of contention both in reproductive health research as well as in education research. So the analysis of this data presents an important contribution to the science of teen fertility in South Africa. Now, before I move on to the heart of the presentation, it's important for us to establish a common understanding of some terminology used in this field. And I'm going to distinguish between two terms: fertility rates and pregnancy rates. Fertility rates refer to pregnancies that result in live birth, while pregnancy rates refer to both live births and pregnancies that have been terminated. Now, even though termination was legalized in South Africa since 1996, we do not capture terminations well enough in administrative or survey data. So the data tends to be unreliable with regards to termination. So when I talk about pregnancy or fertility, and I might use them interchangeably in the presentation, what I'm actually referring to are fertility rates. So pregnancies that result in live births. A second proviso to the presentation is that South Africa does not collect vital statistics on fertility, pregnancy, or termination, which means that we don't have adequate data around birth registration in South Africa. So all of the data that I'm referring to in terms of fertility have been derived from these national surveys that I referred to earlier. In order to understand teenage fertility, we have to contextualize it in terms of overall fertility in the country. So fertility amongst women aged 15 to 49. And what the picture shows us is that overall fertility has been declining in South Africa for the past 50 years. that is amongst women aged 15 to 49. And in fact, South Africa has the lowest fertility in mainland sub-Saharan Africa. And in line with this overall decline in overall fertility, teenage fertility has also been declining in the country. However, it has been declining at a slower pace than overall fertility because it is subject to periodic spikes with regards to teenage fertility. And this is related to national events. I'll take two examples. During 1976, when lots of young people were out of mainstream systems in terms of education, in terms of work, we experienced a spike in teenage fertility. Similarly, in the mid-1990s, as we experienced the transition to democracy, there was concern for lost generation, lots of young people outside of mainstream systems of education and work, and we experienced a spike in fertility. And that is because fertility is so closely related to socioeconomic status. However, fertility has declined by 10% between 1996 and 2001, and the 2007 community survey shows us that it has declined by further 10% by 2007. And this is exactly what this next picture shows us, is that there's been a decline in fertility since the 1980, between 1980 and 1990, a spike in fertility in the mid-1990s, and then a sustained decline thereafter. Now, there are a number of reasons for why... Could I get some assistance with the slides here? Okay. There we go. There are a number of reasons for why the perception of an upsurge has persisted despite the availability of data. One of which is that historically when a young woman experienced a pregnancy, she was sent away to family in a rural area to give birth to a child and then she returned to her family. However, now that we live in a rights-based society, there's increased visibility of teenage pregnancy. You can see young women attending schools, we can see them in communities, and we can even see them collecting the child support grant. And this has fueled, in some respects, this perception of an upsurge in teen fertility in South Africa. In addition, with the decline in overall fertility, the proportion that teens contribute to overall fertility has increased over time. There's also a confluence of a number of factors that I will discuss in more detail later on. Issues around morality concerning reproductive health of young people. There's been increased number of strategies to reduce teenage pregnancy in society. There's greater enforcement of the responsibility of young women for an early pregnancy. And society is increasingly providing assistance to children who are born to teen mothers. And all of these factors together contribute to this perception of an upsurge, even though the data is showing us that there's been a decline in overall fertility. Now, rates in teen fertility differ for some subgroups of the population. The first I'll take is age. We know that older adolescents aged 17 to 19 account for the bulk of teen fertility. This is exactly what this pie graph is showing us, that young women aged 17, 18, and 19 years of age account for 93% of teen fertility in South Africa, and this is contrary to popular perception that very young girls are experiencing pregnancies. There might be pockets of this, but in fact 17 to 19-year-olds account for the bulk of teen fertility in the country. Moving on to population groups, we see that pregnancies are much higher among African and colored young people, and in fact, rates among Indian and white young people approximate developed country rates. With respect to where young people reside, rates are much higher in rural areas, and this was derived from the 1998 South African Demographic and Health Survey. Unfortunately, the data was not differentiated for urban informal areas. But if we look at HIV prevalence, and I've said before that HIV and teenage pregnancy share many common risk factors. If we look at this slide on HIV prevalence, we see that rates are almost double in urban informal areas. So it's telling us that this is perhaps an area where we might need to intervene, and we need to differentiate our data for urban informal areas. Yes. Okay. Okay, so what this graph shows us is HIV prevalence by geography type. The first slide refers to rural formal areas, it's 13.5%. The second graph refers to rural informal areas, it's 8.7%. The third bar refers to urban formal areas. It's 9.8%. And the fourth graph refers to urban informal areas, which is 17.4%. 17.4%. So in fact, rates are much higher in urban informal areas than in any other residential type. Okay, then moving on to the analysis of the education management information system data. We need to preface this with a caution that there was lots of missing data in some of the provinces. So the findings that I'm presenting are more indicative rather than definitive in terms of learner pregnancies, but they do provide some guidelines. What the analysis showed is that there's been a rise in learner pregnancy in schools between 2004 and 2008. Now, this is in the complete opposite direction to what national data sets are telling us. So, in fact, this is most likely the result of improved reporting rather than a real increase in learner pregnancies in the school setting. We also tried to differentiate the types of schools in which learner pregnancies might be concentrating. And what the results showed us was that learner pregnancies tend to be higher in schools located in poor neighborhoods. So schools in which are classified as no-fee schools, schools located in farm areas or on independently owned land. Learner pregnancies are also higher in schools involving lots of age mixing, so combined schools, where there's a large variation in the age range amongst learners. And this makes sense. I will talk about this a little bit later in terms of imbalanced gender relations, where there's a large age variation between learners. And then the third factor is schools that are poorly resourced tend to also experience a higher level of learner pregnancies. Moving on to a very contentious issue, which is the link between the child support grant and learner pregnancies. There was lots of attention given to this in the media, that young women may be falling pregnant to be able to access the child support grant. Now, the Department of Social Development commissioned 4 studies. There could be more, actually. And in fact, what it shows is that there is no empirical evidence to support a link between teen fertility and the child support grant. In fact, throughout the period that the child support grant has been available, teen fertility has been declining in South Africa. Secondly, there are some indications that termination of pregnancy might have been increasing during the entire period that the child support grant has been available. So, I mean, this is counterintuitive. If teen pregnancy is increasing, it doesn't make sense that young women will be falling pregnant to access the grant. There's also been very low uptake of the child support grant amongst young women. In fact, it is grandmothers who access the child support grant on behalf of these young women to support these grandchildren. There's also evidence of higher school enrollment and better nutrition to children who access the child support grant. So, in fact, the money is being used for what it is intended. It's being used to support the nutritional status of the child rather than as a financial benefit for the mother. Okay, then moving on to the link between education and fertility. There's a strong association between educational levels and fertility in South Africa. And the South African Demographic and Health Survey data shows us that as education increases, this is associated with a concomitant decline in fertility. So in fact, education is protective against teen fertility in South Africa. Now, there's been much debate in both local and international research as to whether pregnancy causes dropout or is there as a result of dropout. Now, what our data is showing us is that this is a false argument. Pregnancy and dropout share many common causes, chief amongst which is poor school performance and poverty. So young people who perform poorly at school are at increased risk for dropping out of school early on and of experiencing early fertility. Similarly, young people who experience financial barriers are at increased risk for dropout and for early pregnancy. So while pregnancy might be the end point most closely associated with dropout, it is often not the cause of dropout. In fact, what our data in South Africa shows us is that dropout in most cases precedes pregnancy. Analysis of the 2003 HSRC survey has shown that premature exit from the schooling system doubles the risk for early dropout from the schooling system for both young men and for young women. Similar evidence is also available from the 2003 RHRU survey with respect to HIV. And what it shows is that early exit from the schooling system quadruples the risk for HIV amongst young women. So in fact, retaining girls in school may be one of the best interventions that the education system can offer to protect against pregnancy and HIV. Now, despite South Africa's progressive policy regarding learner pregnancy, only about a third of teenage mothers actually return to the education system post-pregnancy. And this is because of a number of factors: inconsistent application of the policy, few childcare alternatives, poor school performance, and so on. Data from South Africa suggests that the longer that teen mothers are outside of the schooling system, the less likely that they ever to return to schooling. So we may have to relook the policy guidelines that suggest up to a 2-year waiting period before mothers return to school. The best interests of the mother and the child are served when the mother has increased her educational level. So getting girls back into the school as quickly as possible might protect both the child and the mother's outcome. Now, we also briefly looked at the available evidence on termination of pregnancy. And although termination of pregnancy has been legalized in South Africa, available since 1997, there's still some uncertainty about the extent to which young women make use of legal services in South Africa. Now, the 2003 RHRU survey suggests that only 3% of young people terminate pregnancies, while more recent data from the Department of Health suggests that youth account for up to 30% of terminations. So we really need to focus on strengthening and reconciling both survey and administrative data sources with regard to termination to get an accurate picture of the extent to which young women are making use of legal services. What qualitative research suggests is that termination is still highly stigmatized in South Africa. And despite the fact that young women recognize that termination is morally objectionable, they apply a relative morality to teen pregnancy, to termination, simply to protect their educational opportunities and because of a realism about the social and financial hardships that an unplanned pregnancy brings. What this type of research suggests is that young women do terminate, but that the use of illegal terminations are still high. Now, some of the barriers to the use of legal services include: there's a persisting lack of knowledge about the legality of termination, about costs related to termination, even though we know that it is available free of charge, and about the period of gestation during which pregnancies can be safely terminated. Now, because of the ensuing stigma related to pregnancy and to termination in the community, and that replicates itself in the health system, no young woman wants to face her aunt in the health system who will duly report back to her parents that she has terminated a pregnancy. So they choose not to make use of legal services. And lastly, young women are seldom the sole decision makers about termination. It is often decided by mothers and older female family members, or dictated by a partner who is keen on protecting his own educational aspirations and economic opportunities. So much more empirical research is required to understand termination of pregnancy amongst young people and the extent to which they make use of legal services. So that brings me to the end of our mapping of teen fertility in South Africa. It really represents a policy win in South Africa, in that it is an area in which we have tangible evidence of the success of legislative interventions. Now, there are three principal reasons that we can put forward for the decline in teen fertility. Number one, since the 1970s, there's been a progressive increase in access to family planning services. Of course, before democracy, we know that access to family planning services was not provided from a rights-based perspective. However, what we are seeing is a dramatic increase in contraceptive use, in particular condom use, and I will show you a slide that demonstrates this increase in condom use. And we know that this has been partly the result of information campaigns around HIV that have played a big role in increasing contraceptive use amongst young people. The second issue for the decline in fertility, again since the 1970s, there's been progressive increase in access to education, particularly to the advantage of African youth and to women. Now, given that education is such a strong determinant of teen fertility in South Africa, it's therefore not surprising that the rise in education has been associated with a concomitant decline in fertility. And thirdly, what we've noticed in the literature review is a shift in attitude towards early pregnancy. Unlike the early 1990s, when pregnancy was welcomed as a sign of love, of womanhood, and of fertility, Over two-thirds of young women now say to us that they don't want to experience an early pregnancy because of their high educational aspirations and a realism around the financial hardships that an unplanned pregnancy brings. However, that being said, teenage fertility remains unacceptably high in South Africa. And while we have made some inroads with respect to sexual risk factors, in the words of Rachel Jukes, an eminent scientist in South Africa, teenage pregnancy is a deeply rooted social phenomenon related to the social conditions under which we grow up and which we live. And unless we start to address the social drivers of pregnancy, rates will continue to remain unacceptably high in South Africa. So what are some of the reasons for high fertility? While young women have almost universal knowledge of modern methods of contraception, however, high levels of incorrect and inconsistent use persist in South Africa. As I mentioned earlier, what this next picture shows us is a rise in condom use amongst young men and young women. It's derived from the three rounds of the HSRC HIV prevalence survey. And what this next picture shows us is that when we ask young women what are the main reasons for early pregnancy, over two-thirds of them said to us, I did not use contraception. So in fact, the failure to use contraception is one of the main reasons for high levels of teen fertility in South Africa. 50 years of public health research has shown us that behavior is seldom the result of single individually attributable factors. In fact, health behavior is the result of a complex set of factors that are interrelated and strongly rooted in the social conditions under which we grow up. And so to understand the multiple levels of influence on contraceptive use, on sexual behavior and teen fertility, we need to adopt an ecological model as a conceptual framework. Such a model recognizes that we need to move beyond health education for individuals to changing relational factors and institutional behavior, influencing physical and social environments, and advocating for enabling policies. Now, Douglas Kirby, a scientist who works in this area in the U.S., identified over 100 determinants of teen fertility in that context. And similarly, in our review of the determinants of teen fertility in South Africa, we identified a whole host of factors, some of which are inherent to who this young person is, so inherent to this individual, but many more related to the homes, communities, and institutions that young people interact with on a day-to-day basis. Now, in the interest of time, I will highlight a few of these key determinants in our context. These relational and structural factors are deeply rooted in the social conditions in which these young people grow up. I've talked about school dropout, that it doubles the risk for early fertility, and that it quadruples the risk for HIV. So early school dropout is a key risk factor for early fertility in South Africa. When young people grow up in impoverished conditions, probably related to the lack of access of education, health services, and under poor socioeconomic conditions, they are at increased risk for early fertility. Now, parents are the most important socializing agent for young people. And when they are absent from the home, particularly the mother, there are few opportunities for young people to be guided around their sexuality and for monitoring to take place. Despite the normalization of teen pregnancy in South African society, it is still highly stigmatized. And what the stigma does is that it limits open communication with partners and parents around sexuality, contraception, and other such sensitive issues. The same stigma that is generated in the community replicates itself in the health system. And despite the rollout of adolescent-friendly clinic services, in some cases, young women are confronted with the scolding and judgment of health staff when they try to access contraception and other reproductive health services within the public health system. And what this does is that it produces gaps in knowledge about sexuality and contraception, and it limits access to contraception. Now, despite a concerted effort to promote women's rights and women's health in South Africa, imbalanced gender relations still persist in South African society. As a result, too many young women are either tricked or forced into having sex for the first time, and this pattern characterizes their sexual relationships well into the future. Under such conditions, there are few opportunities to negotiate safe sex. Now, we know that we live in conditions of pervasive poverty in South Africa, and this forces young women, unfortunately, to make trade-offs between their health and economic security. I'll give you a couple of examples of this. In some cases, young women are forced to engage in reciprocity of sex in exchange for material goods. What I'm talking about here is not transactional sex. When we ask young people about transactional sex, only 3% say to us that they engage in transactional sex. What I'm referring to here is day-to-day life experiences where a young person gets involved with a partner who can provide. And in exchange, it's implicitly implied that sex will happen. Now, in a rights-based society, most young women are aware that they are being forced or coerced into having sex. But most choose to remain in these dysfunctional relationships. In an environment of acute poverty, and in particular, where there are limits to access to education and to be able to find work, sometimes a relationship is the only way to achieve social standing in a community. So they choose to remain in this dysfunctional relationship. It is in this context of needing to meet basic human needs that some young women get involved with more than one partner and sometimes with older men. Now, while there are a range of risk factors that underpin teenage fertility in South Africa, what poverty does is that it stacks overlapping levels of risk among some young people, placing them at heightened risk for early fertility. Under such conditions, these young people have limited access to information to make informed choices, and in fact, with very few poor future prospects, they have very few incentives to protect themselves against early pregnancy. Now, most of the evidence that I've talked about this morning has come from the perspective of young women. But sex is a shared activity between two partners, and it is imperative that we include the role of young men in our analysis of the situation. Yet both locally and internationally, there's very little evidence on the role and experiences of young men in teenage pregnancy. In fact, what evidence is available from the perspective of young women portrays young men as perpetrators and short on taking responsibility for teenage pregnancy. However, a recent South African qualitative study has attempted to fill this gap. And what the study shows is that young men who experience early fatherhood have a very similar profile to young women. They tend to come from poor neighborhoods, they drop out from school early on, and they seldom have the means to provide for this child. And just like young women, they experience a very strong emotional response to news of impending fatherhood. They are shocked out of their minds, they are traumatized, they are embarrassed, they are scared to tell their parents, and generally, they don't know what to do about this early pregnancy. Now, contrary to the perception of young women that men reject paternity, the young men that were interviewed for this qualitative study expressed a very deep sense of responsibility for the child and identified both caring and providing roles for themselves as a father. But in a society where providing is a deeply entrenched role for a man in terms of his family, when asked what defines a good father, in fact, all of these young men said the ability to provide financially. Now, we know that we live in a society where unemployment is particularly high in South Africa, but particularly for young men. 50% of 18 to 24-year-olds are unemployed in South Africa. And these young men, few of them can provide for these children. And this tends to alienate them from taking care of their children. There are two other barriers to fatherhood related to cultural factors and the relationship with female partners. In most cases, families negotiate paternity on behalf of the young man, and as such, he is not involved in deciding on the terms of childcare. So although well-intended, sometimes cultural negotiations of paternity can serve to alienate young men from their children. We need a much better understanding of this to be able to make concrete recommendations. And lastly, when relations break down between the female partner and the male partner, access to the child becomes extremely difficult. Now, given the multiple determinants of teen fertility in South Africa, we know that single strategies from single sectors of society will not solve this issue. There is no magic bullet or quick fix solution for teen fertility in South Africa. What is required is comprehensive approaches that involve every sector of society. And South Africa has responded on multiple fronts, mainly in response to the HIV epidemic. But given the common antecedents between the two, it has conferred benefits to teen pregnancy. However, our response has mainly focused on sexual risk factors, things like improving condom use, changing attitudes, and addressing peer norms. Yet what the available evidence in South Africa suggests is that relational and structural risk factors, things like issues of gender relations, family structure, as well as access to education and poverty, are the key drivers of teen fertility in South Africa. We need a much stronger focus on addressing the relational and structural risk factors for early pregnancy and, for that matter, HIV. Now, as I said, sexuality is a shared activity between two partners. We need much more empirical evidence on the role and experiences of young men in early pregnancy, and we need gender-based interventions that extend the repertoire of fatherhood beyond providing to being present and taking responsibility and caring for these children. There can be no doubt that the primary focus of interventions in South Africa has to be on preventing early pregnancy. However, given that structural and relational factors are very important drivers of teen fertility in South Africa, unless we start to make some inroads regarding youth marginalization, so high levels of unemployment of young people, incomplete access to education, cohorts of young women will continue to experience early fertility. Now, the country can ill afford this loss of human capital potential. We have to start to provide second chance opportunities to prevent these young mothers from being lost from the system forever. It is one way to break the cycle of the intergenerational transmission of early birth and of poverty in South Africa. Now, at some point in time, all young people will confront their sexuality, and as such, all young people need information and skills to make informed choices. And we do have a life skills program in the schooling system. However, much more needs to be done to ensure that every child is reached and that the quality of these programs are optimized to be able to provide quality information. Now, the program is currently focused on HIV. However, we need to ensure a more holistic approach to reproductive health and that teenage pregnancy is not subsumed or lost under the overwhelming challenges that HIV/AIDS presents. We also need more comprehensive and developmentally appropriate messages that include abstinence and safe sex. For young children, of course, we need to punt an abstinence message. However, we know that 30% of secondary school learners are sexually active, and we bear a responsibility to these young people to provide them with the tools to be able to practice safe sex. Now, our system is well versed in teaching young people about the biology of HIV transmission and how a pregnancy occurs. However, we struggle with teaching about the social and structural risk factors, things like imbalanced gender relations, things like the contribution of poverty, etc., towards teen fertility and HIV. And as these are the primary risk factors for teen fertility in South Africa, our programs have to begin to address these risk factors. We should avoid throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Sometimes we label programs as ineffective when in fact we have failed to implement programs as they are intended. Now, a review of the Life Skills program has shown that the program does not necessarily receive the same level of priority as other learning areas within the education system, and that teachers do not always have the knowledge and the skill to be able to teach life skills. They also struggle with their own internal conflicts in having to teach about condom use when in fact their own belief system says that young people, we should not be advocating these strategies to young people. So addressing the barriers to implementation is critical to ensure the effectiveness of such programs. We know that young people struggle less to talk about sex, and we must support educators in the classroom by drawing on the strengths of peer education and other community structures who are well versed in teaching our learners about sexuality issues. Now, the strength of the evidence base for the effectiveness of life skills programs in South Africa is weak at best, and this is similar for most programs in the South African system. However, we can draw on both developing country and developed country experiences to augment our own programs and to put forward effective or promising approaches for interventions. That being said, we need to ensure the evaluation of the efficacy of programs at regular intervals in the country. Now, as I outlined earlier, some young people are at higher risk for early pregnancy because of the stacking of overlapping levels of risk in this group. Now, educators should be given some tools to be able to identify learners who are at increased risk for early fertility in the classroom. Example of these would be young people repeating grades because poor school performance is such an important risk factor for dropout and for early teen fertility. Another example would be young people who have experienced either physical or sexual abuse, young people who are abusing substances, and those living in conditions of abject poverty. If the education system wants to adopt a progressive approach to implementing teen pregnancy programs within schools, a critical entry point would be those schools located in poor neighborhoods and those involving age mixing, because we know that these two factors are such strong risk factors for early fertility. Now, I want to pause here to catch my breath, but also to put across this very important point. I believe that the best social protection that the school can offer against early fertility, and for that matter for HIV, is to retain learners in school, because dropout is such a critical risk factor for negative reproductive health outcomes. Now, conditional cash transfers have been trialed in Brazil, Nicaragua, Bangladesh to address the financial barriers that keep learners out of school. And in fact, RHRU in South Africa is in the process of trialing such an intervention with HIV as an outcome. We need to ensure that a second outcome of that trial is teen fertility. When young people do drop out of the education system, every effort should be made to re-enroll them into the education system, even if it means alternative systems of education. A low-hanging fruit that could be trialed in South Africa is service learning. In the US, programs that involve young people either volunteering their service in communities or participating in communities as part of a school project have shown lower levels of fertility, even in the absence of education for sexuality. Now, the exact mechanism of how this happens is not known. However, it is postulated that learners benefit from being attached to an adult role model, from having a sense of purpose, and being involved in issues larger and wider than their own individual issues. So service learning is a low-hanging fruit that we could consider in South Africa. Coming to the end, as I've mentioned earlier, South Africa has had a very progressive policy regarding teen fertility, and this has protected both the educational and reproductive health outcomes for young people. And in reviewing policy, we should not regress to a punitive approach. I'm going to repeat that. In reviewing policy, we should not regress to a punitive approach. What is required is to ensure that the existing policy is consistently implemented and that we address the barriers to learning for these young mothers. We need to ensure that some advocacy work happens such that educators, learners, and communities are well versed with policy, and where access is denied, we balance rights with the demand for education. We also need to ensure that young mothers are reintegrated into the education system as quickly as possible, within 6 months of giving birth to the child. Any longer and we risk losing this young woman from the education system forever. We know that poor school performance is a significant risk factor for dropout, so ensuring catch-up programs for mothers is critical to prevent dropout and quick second birth. Now, this new mother is facing new economic and social imperatives, and as part of integrated service delivery, a strong referral system is required to ensure access to finance such that the nutritional status of the child can be protected, to provide access to childcare so that the mother can return to the education system, and to offer access to health services. Now, I mentioned this at the seminar. This is a hard-to-hear point. These young women who have given birth to a child are sexually active. And as such, they need access to contraception. And so we need a referral system to the health services for them to be able to access contraception. Now, the education system cannot do this alone. We need other systems of society to support the education system in terms of curbing teen fertility. While the education system fixes itself to prevent recurring dropout, a large cohort of young people will continue to exit the schooling system prematurely. For these young people, community-level interventions are required to school them on reproductive health issues, to challenge gender imbalances in the community, but most importantly, to provide them with skills such that they are able to earn a living. No young women should have to make trade-offs between their economic security and their health. Now, the health system has engaged in rollout of adolescent-friendly services. However, some young people are still confronted with the judgment and negative attitude of health staff when they try to access contraception and other family planning services. We have to ensure that health services are made much more accessible and acceptable to young people, and that we make available the full array of contraceptive services, including emergency contraception, that has proven to be safe, efficacious, and that does not increase sexual activity amongst young people. Now, parents are the fundamental socializing agents of young people. I mentioned this earlier. And we need to empower these parents with the necessary level of knowledge and skill to talk openly with their children about their sexuality and to take back their legitimate right to parent their children. Such an intervention has been trialed in rural KwaZulu-Natal and in fact has been proven to be effective. And what we need to do is to take such interventions to scale. In terms of mass media, programs such as Love Life, Soul City and Komanani have gone a long way in increasing knowledge about HIV, and in fact what the evidence shows us is that they are effective in changing behavior. We need to increase both the coverage and intensity of such programs as part of a comprehensive approach. However, we also need to ensure a distinct focus on pregnancy and that the focus on pregnancy is not overwhelmed or subsumed under HIV. So we need a comprehensive approach towards reproductive health for young people. Now, honourable members, I've talked a lot. It's been a long presentation. It's been a lot to absorb. And the report is even more expansive. But I would be very happy if we all walk away with 6 take-home messages from this presentation. Number one, that teen fertility has been declining in South Africa for the past 2 decades. Number two, that this represents a policy win, and this is mainly due to legislative and biomedical interventions. Number three, and most importantly, that rates remain unacceptably high in South Africa. Number four, teenage pregnancy is a deeply rooted social phenomenon in South Africa. Unless we start to address the relational and social drivers of teen fertility in South Africa, rates will continue to remain unacceptably high. Number five, dropout is a significant risk factor of early fertility in South Africa. And number six, the best social protection that the education system can offer to protect against early fertility and, for that matter, HIV, is to retain learners in school. Thank you very much. I'll now hand over.
No, she'll do it after the presentation, after the question.
Thank you very much. Professor Dr. Pandey, for your nice presentation. Honorable members, I would like to give this opportunity to you to comment on the presentation. You may have your recommendations, you can comment, you can add wherever you see there are gaps in the whole report, as the report has been presented to us before we give this chance to the Department of Education to give us their way forward. But I think it will be proper for us if we can comment to such a long presentation that has been made. Since it has been said this is a societal issue and we all need to have a voice of how can we curb this teenage pregnancy that is affecting our learners at school. Let me open this chance to you, honourable members, for comments. I've noted the chairperson, Comrade Fatima,
Comrade, yes. I've noted two hands. Three. Let me take those hands. I'll come back to others. Comrade Fatima.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is just clarity. two things, well, maybe three things. The first is, I think it would be apt for somebody to explain what the department's policy is with regard to learners who are pregnant but who are in school. At what point does the department allow for flexibility to ensure, for example, that a learner who has just given birth can still write her exams, either supplementary or in December or whatever it is? There was mention made of a return to school after 2-year policy. I'm not sure how that works. Maybe if we can just get some sense of what is the existing policy and how inconsistently is it applied. The second explanation is, do I take it that the rates that you refer to, the 54, I think, in 1,000, which is what is the current rate, would refer to both teenagers within the schooling system as well as without? Is there a figure that shows us what the rate is for learners who are in schools? Because obviously the point that you make quite strongly that it is young people who leave school that are most at risk. Perhaps if you could get a breakdown between those who are in school and the incidents in school as opposed to those who have dropped out. And then lastly, I'm not quite sure about the terminology low-hanging fruits, but in this context, but perhaps you want to explain this concept of service learning a little bit more. I don't think we're very familiar with it here.
Honourable Member, so that when she takes the she can answer all the questions that have been posed to her. Yes. Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm looking at the diagram on, unfortunately these are not page, but the pie thing. Yes. I'm just saying for myself, if I look at these percentages, they obviously reflect females. And one doesn't get an idea about the partners. What I'm saying is, I'm looking at the 1%, the 15-year-olds, the 1% there, where we know, obviously, one wouldn't expect this to happen, that a 15-year-old should be pregnant. And normally, if a 15-year-old is pregnant and is impregnated by somebody who is much older, I think there's something that can be done in law. So I don't know if this cannot really be done to test the 1%. If you do your interviews, and the girl is pregnant, and you get more information about the father, the person who is responsible. Obviously, this can lead to some action being taken against the person who is responsible for this, because obviously, it's a matter of consent here, and we believe that a 15-year-old does not give consent, so it amounts to rape. So I'm just looking at that as, I know it's not an absolute solution, but to a certain extent, it does help. The reason why I'm interested in age is, if you look at the whole thing, you might find that some of the people responsible for this pregnancies are much, I think you touched on older males and so on. I think it is also very interesting, and it might help to know the ages of these people who are responsible for impregnating these younger children. I know it won't solve the problem, but you know, once it goes into the public eye, it might help. You know, people might begin to say, really, what I'm doing is not, it's not right. But because it happens in secrecy, it is a problem. I don't know, it's not going to be easy. to get such figures that, for example, this 2%, 17-year-olds, were impregnated by people of these ages. Because I'm worried about the ages. As you said, it has more to do with the material things. People who are working, who are wealthy, and so on, you know, people in authority, all those things. I think we need to get that information. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Lastly, to Comrade Doctor. Yes. By retaining teen mothers in education, how does that affect other learners? You mentioned that these teen mothers are still sexually active. What example do they set? And is the department concerned about that?
And lastly, can I take you on a loose mind so that you can answer the whole question?
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe let me just appreciate the presentation. I think it was very informative. And my eyes was opened in many instances. But because of that, and my eyes is now open, I will have very short questions, but it's more than five. Is it okay, Chairperson? Very short. Why are you saying there is a perception of an upsurge? While communities say it is unacceptable, these pregnancies of school children especially. And I'm not talking in general, I'm talking school children. Then secondly, you say that CSG, there's a CSG myth, right? Now, and you've stated there's no empirical evidence to substantiate or to support that. And I've seen your other sort of conclusions in this regard, but I'm not convinced. In the absence of empirical evidence, I still have a problem then that you can conclude and stand up and to say it's a myth. So I'm challenging you on that one. Then the dropout is a significant risk factor, as you said. I didn't have a chance to look at the way forward. You stopped at conclusions. So I didn't have, in that regard, I then would like to ask you, can you sort of indicate to us what should be done from your perspective or from your opinion so that we don't have a lot of dropouts? If we, because you said, and you took a long breath when you said retain the learners at school, that's fine. But can you sort of give us more? What did you say to the department yourself? Yes, then the last one. The last one is with regard to mothers, getting mothers back to school as quickly as possible. And you also warned us to say, do not have a punitive approach. I agree. But there is also a moral issue. I want to ask you, do you think it is punitive to say to a child, get back to the school as quickly as possible, but I will send you not back to that school where you were, where you fall pregnant, but to another school, whilst also applying what you recommended by saying other support, social support systems should kick in. So taking care of the child, taking that child, the child now to a daycare, whilst the mother is going to out of town to another school. I'm just making an example. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. I know this thing is drawing a lot of interest from the Honourable Members. Can I just stop here, wait for the responses, then I can take the last round, then we'll continue with the recommendations forward from the department. Or is there the follow-up to another question?
Chair, just a plea. I have to attend another meeting now. I would just like to ask my question. Even if I'm not here for the answer, I would like other people to be able to. So could I? It could be very quick.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I would just like to know whether pregnant mothers are given any guidance, instruction, whether they are prepared for motherhood, either in school or what, within the community. I think so often young mothers just hand over the child to a grandmother. But I think what we need to do is to encourage people to take responsibility for that baby. If it's their baby, they have actually got to look after it. So what about teaching them how to be good parents, about food, nutrition, sleeping patterns, all those sort of things? Cater for that, because I think that's so important. It's also for the pregnant father in that sense, that it's a joint responsibility for life. It's not a little object that's just going to be dumped. I'm sorry I can't stay for the answer, but I'm sure some of my colleagues will let me know. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, another member. Can I take it back to you, Comrade Pandey?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. I'm going to start with answering the question about the current policy of the department, about which there has been some confusion in the public arena. The department's policy is based on the need for non-discrimination against pregnant learners in the system. So it's about ensuring that pregnant learners are allowed to remain in school and are allowed to return to the education system. But it's also about a balance issue. And the measures for the prevention and management of learner pregnancy, which were released in 2007, are really a set of guidelines for schools about how they can deal with teenage pregnancy when it arises. First of all, the measures emphasize abstinence. The approach of the department is really to prevent teenage pregnancy as much as possible. So there's a focus on sexuality and life skills education. But there's also a focus on prevention, encouraging teenagers, obviously, not to fall pregnant. But the issue of management is really treated in the measures as an issue that schools need to engage with parents on a one-on-one basis. And the two-year confusion comes in because the measures propose that in some cases learners may need, there's a balance proposed between, as some honourable members have mentioned, the need for learners who do give birth to take some responsibility for the health of the child post-birth, but also not to take to be able to return to education as well. So it's really a negotiation between the principal of the school, the teachers of the school, and the parents. In the particular, taking into account the particular situation of the learner involved, there may well be a need for a break. The two-year period was not, it's not a policy. It was a suggestion in the measures that possibly for some there may be an up to two-year period needed. Obviously, there are a lot of complicated issues in negotiating these things between the schools and the families. And we do think that, you know, there may be pointers in the study that the HSRC has done for possible looking at some of the guidelines. We think that maybe we might need to look at more specific guidelines. There may be a need to look at how schools do deal with these things. We have different reports. We know that in many schools that they deal very successfully with pregnancies, and there's a lot of experience amongst teachers. We have had negative reports of some schools using the perception of this 2 years policy to keep learners out of school, but we don't think that's the majority. So it's really about protecting the rights of learners and allowing for flexibility within the system. I don't know if the DDG would like to add.
I would like to add that, in fact, the question that the chairperson has asked is actually quite the biggest weakness in the measures, in that they've left a lot to interpretation, and because they provide a guide, it's very easy for some of the schools not to have that negotiation that we're proposing in the measures. That firstly, they rely on the learner reporting that she's pregnant. And therefore assuming that, so if you assume that the learner is pregnant, then you'll be able to get the parents, etc., etc. Now, some of the cases that we've seen, learners don't even disclose that they're pregnant, and therefore things happen. So that's one of the areas that we need to strengthen. And the second one is also an assumption that the parents and the schools would agree on how best to deal with the issue. Some of the parents would feel that I just taking my child out of the school. It's none of your business. You know, this is my issue. Other school principals use it, as Tandy was saying, to exclude. So that ambiguity, I think, for us is one of the things that we need to strengthen. The biggest test is going to be how we balance the values of the families and the schools and of the communities around the matter.
Yeah, the cocktails of whatever they have. I think, DJ, we are going to supply us with that.
Yes, they will in the list that you provide.
Okay. Okay.
All right. I'll take some of the technical questions. In terms of how we measured teen fertility in South Africa, we used national data. So it's a representation of learners or teenagers who are within and outside of the schooling system. But that is why we tried to analyze the EMIS data that asked the question about whether a school has reported learner pregnancies. And in fact, the rate is reported in the report on page 41. And it's reported as 58.22 per 1,000 registered learners. However, as I mentioned, there were issues around missing data for some provinces. So that's why I'm careful around punting that as an absolute figure, because some provinces did have missing data. So in fact, the national data would be more reliable. The EMIS data is showing is that there's been an increase in learner pregnancies, which is completely opposite to what the national data is showing. So we have to be careful around the interpretation of that data. In terms of service learning, so service learning is really about, as part of the academic program, learners are asked to go out and engage in a community project. So they make a contribution to a community NGO or some type of organization engaging in community work. And they come back into the classroom and they have an engagement around what they observed, what they experienced, how they contributed, etc. And so this type of service learning, even when these young people were not educated around sexuality, that the service learning component didn't have a reproductive health component, what the study found was that learners who were engaged in this type of service learning, there was some type of involvement in the community, they had lower levels of teen fertility. And that's why I explained that the exact mechanisms around this is not known, but it has been postulated. But being attached to an adult role model, either within the school or outside of the schooling system, or having a sense of purpose and a sense of direction, and that you're making contributions to society, might have conferred protection to these young people. So that I think the point is that they are part of a system larger than themselves, and that they seem to be going somewhere and making a contribution to society. This work was done in the U.S. by Douglas Kirby, and there is a reference on this that is in the report that you could refer to for further details. In terms of the age of partners, clearly that picture is referring to females, but around the age of partners, when we look at age mixing amongst young people, we find that if young people are involved or young women are involved with a partner 5 years older than themselves, they tend to be at much increased risk for HIV. In terms of teenage pregnancy, it's a differential of 3 years that they have significant risk for an early fertility. So, and if you think about it, I mean, it's really a peer, it's not an older man, if you think about 3 years. But if you think about learners in a combined school, if a 12-year-old is involved with a 17-year-old, one is already probably at the brink of their sexuality, while the other is a little behind. But when they get involved in a romantic relationship, one starts to pull the other in terms of early debut of sexuality. And that becomes a problem. So we have to be careful. There's lots of controversy around this issue. Is it an older man or is it a peer? And generally, if you think about people and how they get involved in relationships, it's normal for a 25-year-old to get involved with a 30-year-old, and that doesn't present a problem. But it does present a problem when a 12-year-old is involved with a 17-year-old because of the differential in terms of their development. Retaining mothers in school and how does it affect other learners? We didn't look at that specifically in the study. That wasn't one of the aims of the study. However, what the study did show was that when these young women return to the school, it is protective against their educational outcomes and it is protective against second birth. In fact, it delays second birth. There's data from the US that shows that 25% of young women who've had an early pregnancy experience a second birth very quickly. And in fact, in South Africa, we have this bimodal pattern of fertility that young women do experience early first birth, but there is a long delay in second birth till the late 20s. And there is qualitative research to show in South Africa when we ask these young women, why is it that you've delayed second birth? It's because they want to protect their educational opportunities. So in fact, the policy has been protective in terms of education and reproductive health outcomes. And for that reason, alone, you know, and besides the issues around being in terms of the constitution and not discriminating against people in terms of their education, this policy has been protective. The issue around the perception of the upsurge, what I was referring to is the perception of an upsurge in terms of teenage pregnancy versus the national data that is showing us in overall decline. The picture that I put up shows very clearly that there's been a decline in teen fertility in South Africa. Now, I'm speaking about this from an evidence-based perspective. I have to speak to the evidence that is available on the table. I mean, this is a very sensitive issue, and it is an issue that will be subject to controversy for a long time because it involves unprotected sex, it involves the sexuality of young people. And it is an issue that society has to deal with, and I can only comment on it from an evidence-based perspective. However, when we develop strategies, we have to bring into community values, etc. However, from the evidence-based perspective, teen fertility has been declining in South Africa for the past two decades. In terms of the CSG myth, the report covers the child support grant on page 103 and 104. I just want to read the one statement to provide the evidence. Further analysis reveals that whereas only 5.3% of young women access the CHG are in the 15 to 19 year age category, the category accounts for 18% of all mothers in the 2001 census. So a large percentage of these young women are in the 15 to 19 year age category, but only 5.3% are actually accessing the child support grant, even though they make up 18% of mothers in the country. Yeah, so very small percentage actually accessing the grant. Okay, in terms of dropout as a significant risk factor and a way forward and what should be done, I mentioned that the two significant risk factors for dropout are poor school performance and poverty. And as part of the recommendations, I suggested that conditional cash transfers could be one way that we could look at curbing dropout within the schooling system. And it has been used in Nicaragua, in Bangladesh, in Brazil, to get young people into the schooling system. And in fact, the trial was or an intervention was trialed in the UK where a pot of money was set aside for young women from low socioeconomic backgrounds to say that if you complete your education, there will be some money available for you to continue with further education. And it has proven to be successful. So it is one strategy that we proposed as an intervention to retain learners in school. Is it punitive to send young women to another school? If it deals with the issue of stigma, then it could be one strategy to get young women back into the schooling system. Because these young mothers who've had a child experience lots of stigma, and stigma is one of the reasons that they don't return to the schooling system. So it could be one strategy that we could look at. However, we have to look at what level of disruption does it bring to their academic performance, etc., and is there synergy between the two schools so that the support can actually continue for this young person. So it could be one strategy that could be considered, as long as it is not from a punitive approach. Whether pregnant mothers are given guidance to prepare for parenthood, one of the suggestions that we've made as part of the life skills program is to say, could we include as part of this life skills program some type of education for young people in general as to what it means to be a parent? What are the responsibilities related to parenthood? Some issues around the timing, when might be the best time to actually be a parent? And what responsibility goes with being a parent? So the proposal was not around post-pregnancy, it's pre-pregnancy, for all young people to understand what are the responsibilities for being a parent. So that was one of the strategies that we proposed as part of the Life Skills Program. I think I've covered most of them.
Thank you very much.
I did. As I said, we did not collect data on what is the impact of an early pregnancy on other learners in school. This was a literature review, so we didn't go out and collect data from learners within the schooling system. We pooled together existing data in South Africa, so it wasn't the focus of this study. I'm not aware that there's data in South Africa as to the impact of learner pregnancies on other learners, and I can speak from this from an evidence-based perspective purely. Surely there must be an impact. But what I did refer to in terms of the argument around that is that there could be an impact on other learners, and it could be negative. But largely for these young women, in terms of their rights in South Africa from the Constitution, we cannot discriminate against people in terms of the access to education. And that is why I made the argument around the fact that getting these young women into the schooling system is actually protective of their educational outcomes and of their reproductive health outcomes. And that's how I made the link between those two questions. But we don't have data specifically to address that issue.
So can I just add, I think for me it really reinforces the need for a life skills program based on values, because what you want is not a reactive measure or intervention that's targeted at a problem that has already existed. What you want is an ongoing program in schools that looks at values, so that in fact the effect must be the other way around, that when they come back to school, that positive effect must rub off. So for me, the strengthening of life skills program is not just around sexuality education, etc. It's around the positive values, resilience skills, so that young people, regardless of what is thrown at them, they are able to make positive choices, but that they are able to influence their peers in a positive manner.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Okay, you can come in then. I've just noted different hands. Then I'll come back to you so that you can make comments and then round off before we go to the way forward. Fatim, come.
Somebody said earlier that, you know, we haven't specifically within our education system prioritized life skills, and I think that's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. But I think what we haven't done as well is we've prioritized, yes, there's certain social prevalence issues that we've prioritized, such as HIV. I was making the example the other day at the dinner where my daughter was in grade one, could come and tell me a little rhyme about HIV virus and so on. But when I said to her, do you know that you must wash your hands when you come out of the bathroom? She doesn't know that. So she knows the HIV virus, she knows that it kills, she can act out, and she says, you know, then she collapses and she says, did I die nicely? You know, that kind of thing. But the basic things about health, and particularly in this kind of environment that we're in, where flu is actually killing people and so on, they're not taught those kinds of things. Why? Because there is this attachment to this social priority that we have. And likewise,
even with teenage pregnancies, we stand to risk the idea of prioritizing this particular social dilemma that we have above other issues such as building character or character building in school. So for me, it's about those basic lessons of respect, of loyalty, of honesty, of and then, as you point out, Deputy DG, the point of the matter is, regardless of what then is thrown at the child in later years, that child is then equipped to deal with the matter. But we have to give preference and priority to those basic values that are shared across religions, across moral values, and so on. And if we don't do that, and we don't do it soon, we're going to be saddled with huge social problems in our society, including, for example, things like violence at schools and so on. These are measures. I mean, if you teach a child to respect a tree, there's no way that child is going to disrespect the teacher. You know, it's those simple issues that I think we've just kind of, you know, gone fast forward and overlooked, hoping that these things get dealt with at schools. And for me, you know, it's absolutely crucial that we start refocusing the curriculum on those fundamental values.
Thank you, Honorable Fatima. Can I take hands? Can I just note them all? Can I start with the chairperson, Honorable Barbara, followed by Comrade Mashishi, followed by yes. Oh, I've got this right. Yes, we have to follow Honorable and the lastly. Then can we just end there because we're still going to the... Oh, can you be the last one? Then we take the way forward from the Department of Education, then we can wrap up after that. In that order, please.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to slightly disagree with the fact that there is no link between teenage pregnancy and child support grants. And we should also note with caution that research is not always correct. Because the very teenagers that you do research on, those are the very same ones that receive the child support grant. So they would not reveal the truth. But we stay with these teenagers in our communities. We know exactly what goes on. We know that the child support grants, in some instances, do not end up in the correct beneficiaries. Hence, you get some of these kids being brought up by the grandmothers. But you find out that the grant is collected by the mother. So there is a great link. In fact, a terrible link. You'll be shocked as to what really happens after that grant has been collected. You'll be surprised. We see these things in our communities. And also, I would also not want to, and I don't want to be heard wrong here, I would not always agree on the issue of poverty being the main reason for teenage pregnancy. Because you find kids from the best homes, the best fed homes, they fall pregnant. The kids we get at these beautiful social clubs, those are kids from well-off, you know, families. And also I would think that we need to try and pull the role of the churches in this regard. And the role of sports facilities. I mean, we would curb a teenager being in bed rather than being in the sports field. So those are some of the things we need to talk about. And also I think the role of rural development, especially in rural areas, plays a bigger role. We would need to pull in rural development as well. Thanks for now.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I was covered on two issues, that one of prioritized life skill in schools and the role of teachers. But I'll come to my question. On the EMIS data, it was not a breakdown according to provinces. We don't know in provinces what is happening. And again, on that one of parents, we talked about open communication. I was suggesting that on open communication, we should not only look at girls, but both girls and boys should be involved on that one. And then again, you talked about the 2 years of waiting period. I just want to check, is still on the discussion, or are you going to implement it now? And then I was saying I'm supporting the idea because it will decrease teenage pregnancy when it's in place. And the last thing, Chief Director Chandi talked about discrimination. You said that you did not want to discriminate anyone to get access to education. Yes, but the other problem is you find that at schools, these young girls, they give birth at schools. I was maybe suggesting that we should know, maybe we should come up about the waiting period. But I don't know about our culture, because sometimes they can't tell you how many months I have. But I think we need to come up, you need to come up with something. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks. Yeah, it was important to see that you're talking about it being broader than just sex, because in our experience, talking to youth who are perhaps in trouble and addicted and whatever, and you talk about why did they have a baby, and that they really get very romantic about it, in the sense that they want to, that unconditional love, a child that will just love them, and somehow they think it will cement a relationship that will last forever that they didn't see their parents having, and which of course it all blows up in their faces. But it's more than sex, it's really a craving to have that deep connection and whatever. So the parenting that was being spoken about, the classes in schools about responsibility and whatever, and then you mentioned a model that's working in KwaZulu-Natal where you're actually accessing, or parents are accessing, this kind of teaching. But how are you getting to those parents? I mean, at what point are parents waking up and thinking, oh, we need to know how to give our kids more attention? So I'm just interested around that, because I think it's very important, and not getting that very clearly. And then is the department very involved in trying to broaden access for girls to some, you know, because in some situations it might be fine for that girl to go to school in that community, but in a lot it wouldn't be. And are there partnerships with NGOs, kinds of shelters that would be specific to girls who still need to finish education? Because I imagine there's more we could do in terms of creating something that girls could access, where they could complete education. They're out of any community where they're affecting other people are affecting them. And you know, I know it all involves money, but obviously I just want to know if there's any efforts being put in that direction. And then it was just, there was a talk about the data around termination of pregnancy not happening. I'm just thinking, you know, recommendation there, surely it would be extremely important for us to know what is going on in that regard. Because I would have thought that was clearly a place that we would need to know and have data on who's accessing why. I mean, we hear stories about 12-year-olds being taken in by their abusers and being given condoms and sort of to carry on. So with no links to checking and seeing that child is then protected thereafter. So the idea of no data, so I'm thinking, to me it just becomes a recommendation that we've got to have that kind of data. And then you mentioned the legislation that has been responsible for the decrease. Are you specifically talking about CTOP, or are you talking broader than that? And yeah, that covers some of what I think.
Honourable members, in the interest of time, can we be very brief in our comments or questions, please, so that you can continue. Yes, Honourable.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I was listening to the department while they were responding to questions here. One of the questions which was responded is the one where the child is pregnant at school at that particular time. They said the parents, educators, and the child, they must see to it about that problem, how to deal with it. I don't think it will be correct in that fashion. We must come up with a policy and say if that child is pregnant, then the manner in which they can deal with that problem is like this. So I think we must do that. Because this issue of pregnancy is frustrating the educators. I'm talking from practical point of view, frustrating the educators. If a child is still very well, there is a parent. Should the child fall pregnant, there is no parent coming at school. It's a serious problem. We need to assist in this regard. And one of the fundamental points, it's a nursing part of it. When the child is pregnant at school, there is no period of when a child will go home or go to hospital for delivering that particular baby. Then who is nursing that child at that particular time? I should think we need to be clear. Because this thing is frustrating the educators. Whether they must expel the child or leave a child until the last day. Because there is no period stipulated for a child to go home and deliver that particular baby or what. And also, when the principal and the educators, including the SGP, acting on that particular matter, maybe taking a child at home, then there is a law which says a child is having a right to learn. You can't expel that child because pregnancy is not a disease. Then how do we assist in this regard? As a department, we need to come up with a policy. A policy that will outline this issue very clearly and make educators, parents, SGPs not to be in the frustration so that they can be able to deal with that with this matter. And also I must comment on the presentation that you made, particularly the recommendations. They will assist maybe in future. But let's talk about the issue which is existing now at school A. There are lots of children who are pregnant, as we are talking now. But who is nursing them? And you cannot expel them at school. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is, how high are the rates on teenagers who are disabled, especially the school-going learners who are in rural areas? And you spoke about the provinces with the missing data. Which provinces are those, and how have you dealt with those provinces? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine was on CSG, so I'm not going to ask that question because it's already asked. And then mine is on the guidelines. And the guidelines was covered within the frustrations. Because when we look at the South African Airways, you know, when it comes to the child being at school, because you speak about retention afterwards, but a child is pregnant at school, the frustrations the principal faces. And then there's no guidelines. Mine was on guidelines itself. South African Airways don't allow any person that's 28 weeks pregnant on a plane. And then the other thing is this too, when it comes to educators, they go off on 28 weeks. So we need to have proper guidelines in place. How long can the child stay? Then my other question was on... I want to speak to the moral regeneration program because a person is not sure where is it located, because that is part of government's program that we have to bring into education itself. Because like the chairperson said, life skills are important and we're not concentrating on that as it should be in schools. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Can I just take it back to the Department of Education? But I'm also interested as to say, having got such a report, within the Department of Education, all the directorates, do you ever sit down to interact with such reports? Because really, when you look at these reports, they don't only need your own directorate, but when you look at a poor resourcing of schools, you need to refer that to the responsible directorate, and there are so many things, age mixing and whatever. So do you ever get a chance where you sit, and so that you can direct all these reports to the responsible directorate, so that we can see there's a report, we can rip fruits out of this report? Because really, once you end it here with your own directorate, there are so many answers, there are so many questions that you need to be answered to, but we won't get responses if such a report will only remain with this directorate. Thank you.
It's actually when it comes to the educators, because like I come from the Eastern Cape, and you were speaking here to, you know, when it comes to exchange material goods. And within the Eastern Cape, we had a principal that made 20 girls pregnant. A teacher that gave a child HIV and AIDS, you know, I visited the school. And they were disciplined. But now we are saying the teachers have to do the life skills. What are we doing to when it comes to the morals of our teachers? That will be important too. Thank you.
Yeah, can we get the response?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me answer the ones that were directed at the department. I'm actually happy that we're having the discussion around measures, because it indicates the complexity of having a policy statement in this area. We've had such varied, because the matter is subjective. As a parent, I would react in a particular way, but you're also finding you have to balance the rights of the learners, but also the rights of those that are in school that are not pregnant, the educators, whether they have the skills to deal with the matter. So what has been the difficulty is exactly that how do you define a policy in an area that is as complex as this one. But I think what it does also indicate is the need for, I think that the one of the questions, the inter departmental link, because if you're allowing learners who are pregnant to be in schools, you need to have systems, referral systems, so that if something happens, the learner is able to access health services. But that assumes that health services are there, whether within the schools or within the communities. So the importance of all the services coming together at the school, in service of the school, is key if you're going to balance the rights of learners to education and also and protect educators. Because in some instances it's precisely because there is no access. So first I just want to acknowledge the complexity. And to say that in fact the measures indicate that the learner must go to a doctor or a health service and must produce evidence of going to a health service over time. But again, it assumes that there is that service in that community. The second issue is around in that respect, in the department in particular, this is being discussed at senior management, at an inter-branch, but we also have an inter-provincial committee. We would like, when we come back with the program, to be able to make those connections, because the plan for this must exactly speak to what planning around no-fee schools, etc. I also wanted to make a point about poverty. I think for me the issue about poverty is, whilst I agree that it's not probably the main determinant, but it's an issue of opportunity. A lot of the studies show that in fact if young people do not have any aspirations, there doesn't seem to be any thing that they aspire for, they tend to get into risky behavior. So it's as much about it is about perceived opportunity in those areas. Around second chance, we're very fortunate that now we are looking as a department at a multitude of second chance opportunities certainly for out of school youth. I know that the Department for Higher Education and Training is looking at post-school options for young people that drop out of school, and that is linked to the review of the college system, so that they provide programs beyond just the MCV. So wide variety of skills programs. We have now, we're in a writing process for an alternative part-time matric certificate, so that those that drop out of matric are able to access matric part-time. We have in writers now that are writing the program. So I think at least that will go a long way in dealing and addressing the issues of young people that are dropping out of the system. The moral regeneration movement, through the clusters we're working with them, but I just wanted to alert the honorable members that we, last year or early this year, we spoke about the Bill of Responsibilities that we introducing in schools. And at the heart of the Bill of Responsibilities is exactly what the chairperson was saying, that, you know, we have the constitutional values, the big ones, but we have those ones that are real, responsibility, respect, all of those that we need to make sure that we put a program for in school. We, whilst we had the poster, we now in fact have a teacher's guide for school, so that there is a program linked to the poster. So it's not just a poster that you put in schools, but you work through those values one by one and what it means for young people. And maybe we can have a broader conversation with young people around that. The good thing about the Bill of Responsibility is that it was developed by us and the Religious Forum, which is a cross-cutting body of religious bodies. Because as the chairperson was saying, those values cut across different religions. I think from the department aspect, I've answered the question.
Okay, with respect to CSG and teenage pregnancy, you know, I don't think we're going to solve this issue here. The data that has been used to analyze it from the HSRC perspective is SASA data, for social security data linked to national trends in teenage fertility, so from national surveys. And the data is very clear that there isn't a link. However, this is an issue beyond data that society has to engage in. And perhaps we need champions in society to come together to look at what are the key messages and decide how that can be filtered down. But we did ask, there is some data to show from the perspective of young people, and I've put it up on the slide, and that's reported reasons for pregnancy. And you can say only 2% of these young people in the survey identified, I want to get the child support grant as a reason for experiencing a pregnancy. I mean, we can contest the issues around the survey and the representativity, etc., but I don't think we're going to win the argument purely on the data. This needs to move to another realm. We need another type of debate to be able to decide how we take this matter forward. But from an evidence-based perspective, the data is showing that there isn't a link. And I think it's best that I leave it there. We could talk about it differently in another debate. The issue around poverty being the main reason, as I indicated, that this is a very complex issue, and that there are some factors that are more proximal or that are closer, like contraceptive use. If you ask young people, why did you experience a pregnancy, they'll tell you, because I failed to use contraception. And poverty is a more distal factor or a structural factor. But if you look at every level, from the individual level to the interpersonal level to institutional to structural, poverty is an underlying or underpinning factor. So poverty might limit access to contraception because there's limited access to health services in a particular area. So what we are trying to say is that poverty is an underlying factor. The most immediate factor might be access to contraception. And what poverty does is that it stacks overlapping risk factors among some young people because of access to education, access to services, lower socioeconomic status. And as Gugu mentioned, it says limited opportunities to get information, but also limited incentives to protect oneself. So it's about opportunity. Where am I going? Are there future prospects for me, etc.? Okay, the role of the churches, sports facilities, absolutely. As I mentioned, we need a comprehensive approach. Single sectors of society are not going to solve this issue. We need a multi-sectoral approach. Various sectors need to come together to play a role in this. In terms of the EMIS data in the provinces, we did look at the provinces. Rates were higher in the Eastern Cape, KZN and Limpopo, so related to access to resources, etc. Parents and open communication amongst girls and boys, of course, because we said that sexuality is a shared activity. We cannot continue to empower girls without empowering young boys as well, because they share responsibility to protect against unprotected sex. Absolutely, sex represents much more to young people than just sexual activity. It's a representation of love. It's about being wanted and about being needed. So it's much more than just having sex. The model from KZN, the project is called CHAMP, and what it did was that it recruited parents via the schooling system. So it recruited parents and their children to participate in the project. Now, one of the issues that is discussed in this report around parenting programs that it is often difficult to recruit parents. But once they are recruited into programs, it tends to have phenomenal success, that you're able to increase their knowledge, you increase their skill level to talk openly about sexuality, but also to take back their right to parent their children. We've had this controversy in society that we've been promoting child rights, but we're not promoting parental rights. And sometimes there's a gap, there's an intergenerational gap in talking about issues of sexuality, and that parents struggle to take these issues on. So when there are programs provided to increase their knowledge and their skill level, they actually do it very successfully. And the project is called CHAMP, and it was trialed in rural KwaZulu-Natal. In terms of termination of pregnancy, well, the data systems, besides the Department of Health data system not collecting the data adequately, there's still persistent use of illegal services. And there isn't a control of how this is happening or where it is happening. And that's why we tend to say that termination of pregnancy data is unreliable, because we have such high use of illegal services, and there isn't a control over that. And until we can get those systems right to get people to make use of termination of pregnancy or legal services, we will continue to have an issue. But also there's an issue around, if you think about the schooling system, and we ask about learner pregnancies, we don't know if somebody has fallen pregnant and terminated very quickly. What we are seeing is probably a learner, when they are visibly pregnant at the school, they notice, okay, this child has experienced a pregnancy. And we need to start to reconcile all of those issues to be able to say that we can rely on the data that we have for termination of pregnancy. In terms of the legislation being successful, I was referring to the entire package of family planning services, that we do have this termination of pregnancy legislation, and that might have made a contribution. But largely I was referring to the access to contraception that has been available in South Africa since the 1970s and has probably made a huge contribution towards increasing contraceptive use amongst young people in South Africa. The rates among disabled, unfortunately, the power of the data did not allow us to disaggregate to that level. But it is an area that we would have to look at, because young people who are disabled experience other difficulties as well. And they could be a risk, a group who are at much higher risk for early pregnancy. In terms of areas in which there were missing data, Limpopo was one of the provinces where there were lots of missing data, KZN as well. So those were provinces in which there were issues, Eastern Cape as well, around missing data. I think I've answered all of the technical questions.
Thank you very much. Let us just go straight to the straightforward. But before we do that, Honorable Kanya, there's an old man.
I'm sorry, I made a request in writing just to say something. The because, you know, the time given for this discussion is so limited, and we, you know, the topic needs to be discussed very, very thoroughly. You know, overhearing people talking about something, it's a very difficult thing to participate in. If you hear people, you know, talking about something and you are not part of it, but you are just overhearing, you don't know how to get involved there. Now, I want to support what the lady next to me said here about what is happening out there in the communities. We know what is happening, we see what is happening. I overheard two girls talking about the galloping buffaloes. Now, the galloping buffaloes are on the 100 rand. Now, one was asking the other one how many galloping buffaloes she gets when they go for this child support grants. It is very important, you know, but I couldn't say anything because she was not asking me, but I overheard that. I just want to tell you, serious things are happening there. Even if you say 2% there, I've seen the 2% there about those who engage because they want to socialize. I think it might be even far more than that. But lastly, let's leave out the galloping buffaloes. Lastly, I just want to make a recommendation with regard to life skills education. I wonder whether you have ever thought of itinerant school social workers and school psychologists. Because we say there is life skills in the schools, but the question is, who is dealing with these life skills? Are they properly trained to deal with this type of issues that are so difficult, so complex? So maybe if we could, as education, move into the area of, you know, appointing people as itinerant school social workers and itinerant school psychologists to support the teachers, it might help us to address some of the problems. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Sanyaho. Can I not respond to that? Can you say to Sleti with her report?
Okay. Thanks very much, Honorable Members, colleagues. Upon receiving the report from the HSRC, we have had thorough discussions internally about how we wish to respond to that, and also with the Minister. And we've all agreed that we accept the results and the recommendations of the report. But while we welcome the news that there's a deadline, we are still as unhappy as we were when we didn't know that there's a deadline to the problem. So all efforts towards preventing teenage pregnancies are still on. And we're happy that you invited us here, which is an indication that you're joining us on this fight. Basically, our response to the issue is, as my DDG and Chief Director have already said, is from a race-based point of view and also gender-sensitive. What it means is that we are not going to take away a right to education to any girl who is pregnant. And we are not going to just apportion blame to the pregnant teenagers and then be insensitive in our response and in the way we deal with them. And also that will take into consideration the needs of both boys and girls as we go forward with the work that needs to be done. So all our strategies that will come out will be informed by that perspective as per our constitutional mandate. As members have already said, and also Dr. Pandey and other stakeholders that we have seen, this is not a problem for one department or for one institution or for a parent or for a teenager. This is a societal problem, and for us to succeed in dealing with it, we need a societal solution. So we agree with everyone that we need active involvement of all stakeholders, and this includes the government, which would be primarily departments of health, education and social development. And we've had also recommendations that the Department of Sports should be as active, and now also the Department of Rural Development. And then there is also the need to work with the relevant NGOs, the learners, the parents, also traditional leadership, and teacher unions, SGB associations. We think that joint efforts from all the stakeholders and more that I may not have mentioned will allow us to work towards ensuring realization of our vision where all learners can reach full potential in their lives. In the last week, our minister convened a seminar on teenage pregnancy in which she released this report. And the seminar was well attended. Members from this desk were also represented. We also had traditional leaders and religious leaders, NGOs, and sister government departments, and so on. So in the seminar, we had the report presented and discussed extensively. We also got formal responses from the Department of Social Development as well as the Department of Health. But in addition to that, we had a response from learners themselves who had met a weekend earlier to discuss their view of the matter and how and what they think the solution is. And these are members of what is called the Girls and Boys Education Movement. They had so much to tell us about this issue. Some of the issues that came up in the seminar were centered around the issue of poverty and social relationships, as we've spoken about it here, how it takes some of the blame and how it plays a role in these numbers that we have, and how responding to issues of poverty can contribute to this fight that we're sitting around here talking about today. So from the department's point of view is the need to increase all efforts to keep learners in schools and do our bit in responding to issues of poverty, which means at school level ensuring that learners have access to a meal of some sort, as well as applying the no-fee school policy where it is relevant. Then there was issues of peer pressure and lack of information. Although, you know, it's easier to think that there is a wide understanding of what the issues are and how dangerous it is to engage in early sexual debut and unprotected sex and so on. The study actually proved to us that there is still pockets of young people, especially in rural areas, that remain uninformed and ill-informed, and we need to respond to that going forward. Then we also discussed the issue of mass media and how it should be maximized. We should recognize the role that it plays in informing young people of the issues, and we should use it to the best extent that is possible. The importance of peer education programs, I'll talk about that again later, and also ensuring that young people have sufficient self-esteem and self-respect. Now, one of the issues that young people from the movement told us is required is the need to increase the number of school hours, because they think that when school ends as early as it does, it gives them a lot of time to get up to mischief, mainly because they don't have anything productive to do. And in this regard, they suggest that the school hours be increased, and that means that the school hours must be filled with some form of activities, extracurricular activities. And then they recommend that we make it possible for all schools to have some form of clubs where learners can engage in particular activities, and also sporting facilities and activities to keep them busy When we were at the workshop, Elena asked me what I do after work. Do I go to work and then go home, then come back to work in the morning? And I said to her, no, I actually need to do something recreational in between. And this is what they base their argument on, that they are expected to go to school and go back to their houses when they leave school, and that is not the case. So I think this is a powerful recommendation that they made and that government should discuss and hopefully address. The issue of second chances of teenage mothers, members have spoken largely about this. What we heard is that over and above providing second chances, we need, and this comes from the learners again, to ensure that we give these learners that were pregnant, that are teen mothers, an opportunity to talk to the learners, the good ones, who are not yet pregnant or who are not pregnant, and tell them about their experiences, and that is actually going to help them better understand how they don't want to be pregnant at that early stage. So we thought that, yeah, that would be a good idea, instead of just bringing the learner in back into the system and leaving it to chance that learners who were never pregnant would understand the challenges that she faces. So that's one of the issues that came through in that regard. Then there is a need to empower educators in sexuality education. We've talked extensively about this. But in addition to that, we're getting proposals from the stakeholders that we also need to bring in social workers to the school to respond to this issue, because they might be better qualified and prepared to talk about sexuality. In a meeting that I was in yesterday, the Deputy Minister of Social Development actually spoke about the need to perhaps increase the curriculum of social workers who are in training now to be able to respond to social ills that we're facing today, so that when they get back into the system of work, they can better respond to these issues. And we also got an idea that there needs to be, apparently in the past, there used to be school visits by the nurses or the health system. So the health team would go to a school and do health checks and so on. And that is not happening anymore. And this is more important now, because it will allow the nurses and so on to talk to learners also about issues that they don't want to find themselves involved in, and also help us with the reporting system in government, because currently we rely on the teacher and the principal being able to ID that the learner is pregnant and so on. Okay, thanks. I'm getting a request to move faster. Another issue was to ensure that clinics are youth-friendly. The researcher has talked about that, to make sure that they are accessible and that we have a robust monitoring and evaluation strategy. What we're going to do next, Sadna, thanks, is that we're going to have a series of provincial discussions, and we think that these discussions will help us as we redefine or define what the strategy to deal with teen pregnancy is or should be. And the seminars in the provinces will include all stakeholders that I have mentioned and more. And we'll have, in the end, a strategy that will assist us in preventing and managing school girl pregnancy with emphasis on prevention. And this opportunity also gives us a chance to explore the policy options relating to teenage pregnancy in education. And then there's a number of issues that the strategy is going to look at, among others. One is tools to identify high-risk schools and then have targeted support. And also developing early warning systems for schools. We have heard that before a learner can get pregnant, there is usually signs that they would probably perform poorly and then drop out and so on. So we think that there is a way that we can identify those and react quicker before there is problems. And as I've said, also developing monitoring and evaluation tools to track whatever policy that will be implemented, how effective is that. Then there's the issue of improving life skills programs. We've spoken about that. And also using the clubs and other forums of communication that we can get in order to get the message across. Lastly, we think that all these issues require that we set up an intergovernmental task team to do this work, but mainly to harness on the strengths of each and every stakeholder in identifying ways to prevent teen pregnancy and identifying areas of further research based on the gaps that we will identify, as well as improving the referral system that DDG has spoken about. The last and also most important issue is improving data collection. The members have spoken already about the need to make sure that we can get as much as possible a definitive data around number of pregnant teenagers in schools, also the number of terminated pregnancies to the closest extent of reality that we can. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Just a final word from my side is that we've given ourselves the month of September to continue engagement and discussions on this matter, because we do want to come back certainly to the committee and to cabinet with what we've heard and what the proposed program of action will be in dealing with the matter.
Thank you very much for the way forward that has been given to us. For sure, honourable members, you have identified sort of gaps you want to comment, to add on whatever that you feel might have been left out. I've noticed one hand. Can I just take all the hands, all the people that want to talk, because we only have one round, then we close this session. Can I start to see your hand was up, then just Honourable Barbara, then Honourable Dudley, Honourable Smile, lastly Honourable... Okay, fine, you can leave. In that order. Then I'll end up with... Yes, I see.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, looking at the recommendations, one is thinking about the implementation part of the recommendations, because there are good policies and recommendations that are coming up, but the problem is the how part, because if there was a recommendation that says that each and every school should have a social worker within the school, so that is that social worker that will be able to work with the community, to engage in community on these issues. I think that's the best way we can involve community participation, when there's a social worker that deals with the children's rights in the school. And there are so many retired social workers and retired nurses in our communities that could be utilized, because I think for prevention purposes, it's very important that each and every school as well has got a nurse, so that this is prevented rather than curing after the prevention. So I want to suggest that it is very important that we have an integrated approach in our schools, which we change totally what we had in the past, because it seems as if we're still continuing with what we had in the past. Those schools who can afford do have psychologists, social workers and so on, but those who cannot afford, they don't have those facilities. So I want to propose that I think if schools could have social workers within, nurses within, we could, there could be much better progress
on this particular issue.
Thank you, Honorable, for that addition that has been added on what they've just suggested of using all the departments that are involved. But I think it was just an addition on what has already been said. Bennett, Comrade, Honorable Barbara, can I end up with you as a chairperson? Because I think you are going to wrap up as the chairperson. Can you be the last one on the roll, please? Can I allow the honorable members to come before you?
Thanks, Chair. I just want to say that it would seem we have a great task ahead of us, all of us.
Can you be the last chairperson, please,
okay,
so that you can wrap up from a day? Okay. Can I allow you, Honorable, to then Honorable Smile, then Ms. Denine, then.
Yes, thank you. The way forward looks promising, and it's particularly good to see that you're looking at the concept of increased hours. The social worker concept is very important because obviously on the surface of looking at 60% of, I wasn't using a contraception method, would seem like we're going to dump condoms at the school when it could mean I wasn't using a contraception because I want to have a baby. I wasn't using contraception because I was drunk. I wasn't using contraception because I wanted the grant. So that 66% could help you target more accurately, you know, a social worker there could identify those things that we can't really hear. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, the way forward and what happens next looks okay. But I think the emphasis which I miss is on how to retain learners in school. And we have a shortage of that sort of strategies. And maybe my chairperson in the basic education, maybe it's our homework then to assist in this case. How can we then make sure that learners do not drop out? And if I speak under correction, whilst we were at head office, the department was in denial about the dropout rate. I think you challenged them specifically on the dropout rate. But be as it may, Chairperson, I think, Chairperson Gina, we have got a work to do as a portfolio committee on how to retain learners at school. Maybe I also would like to say, though I do not say the parents who requested for longer school hours are wrong, but in fact, the President said last week, so many hours for teaching, which he didn't say, but I thought maybe by implication, there are also extra-neural, or what? What is the word here? Yeah? You must also do that. You know, you will see why it is indicative that some schools have higher pregnancies, and it comes from, say, the former Model C schools. They have curriculum time and then extra. So you drop your school, your child at 7 o'clock in the morning, you fetch that at 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock. Then everything has taken place. Schoolwork as well as sport and other recreational stuff. So, Chairperson, that is my contribution. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm supporting the idea of school visit because during our times, there were social workers who visited some schools. So this teenage pregnancy was very low. And then let me come to my question of that one of empowering educators in sexuality education. I came across some educators who were having problems with some certain terms in mostly in our language. And then I just want to check, how is the department going to address those terms? Because telling learners other terms is so difficult in our language. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair. No, I was just saying that it would seem we have a great task ahead of us, all of us, but one is encouraged by the fact that at least we are not in conflict, you know. We all agree as to how we are going to move forward. But I was just going to urge the department that perhaps when you have some of these programs, do involve us as the relevant portfolio committees. And I think we could, you know, assist a lot. And I also see a need to make a follow-up on the school hours that the Honourable Member spoke about. And also, we need also to understand that as parents, as government, we wouldn't be having all these problems. Our kids are just, we need to try and move our kids from this new demon of greed, because I think most of our kids are just greedy. You know, you would offer this to your kid. It happens to us as well. But no, they would not be satisfied with what you have offered them. They want that. You know, it's just greed, I think, in most cases that we must deal with. But I do look forward, you know. Also, what I wanted to mention is the fact that sometime we would also be dealing with the issue of the non-implementation of the Children's Act, because that is also a problem. Because that act also, you know, would, in my view, in our view as a committee, would create, you know, a better platform to address some of the issues, preparing these kids for them to be teenagers. Mm. Yeah, I don't want to drag long. I think for now, can I say thank you?
Thank you very much. I think the comments are welcome and they are noted. I do want to say, honourable members and the chairpersons, that I think for us the test of the plan is going to be the extent to which it is interdisciplinary and addresses all of the issues. Because I don't think we can come back here with a plan that just talks about teenage pregnancy. Because my view is that teenage pregnancy is a quality learning and teaching issue. What we need to show as an outcome are those issues that it's a symptom of a bigger problem. So the plan must say what it is that we're doing in fact to still attract learners in schools and retain them and provide them with quality education, because they drop out for a particular reason. So we need to be able to tick all of those issues. And I think it will test government departments, because it must be interdepartmental. We need ourselves, social development and health, must be able to demonstrate to the committees how those services are going to converge to the schools and how we plan for that convergence of services. I wanted to end by saying, Chairperson, that the amazing thing about young people and the conditional and the grant issue was that they feel that, in fact, we could use the grant in a positive way to say that, in fact, if you don't get pregnant, we will keep what you would have had for a bursary. So use it as a positive incentive for you not to get pregnant instead of getting it when you're pregnant. And they said to us, explore using the grant as an incentive and not as something that you deal with. And we thought, I think it's an interesting take on how you use the grant, and I think we need to explore that and make recommendations on that. But thank you very much, Chairperson.
I think I need to thank you, the Department of Education, before I give it to our Chairperson. But really, I think everyone now is in that you are faced with, right, or of which everyone within the community has to make sure that it does contribute towards winning the fight that we are in. Comrade Chairperson Fatima, can I give you this chance to wrap up, then we close the session?
No, thank you very much both to you, Principal Gina, and
for your outstanding chairpersonship and to the department for a good presentation. Obviously, it's an issue that is multi-pronged in its challenges and clearly would require a multi-pronged response. And hopefully our engagement with you would have enriched the process of going forward from here. And regardless of anything else, I think there are two things to bear in mind. The first is the issue of education for children, particularly young women learners, and that the emphasis must be placed on them continuing their education through pregnancies or whatever other challenges. And I think that the department's priority there is correctly placed. You cannot afford in this day and age to have mothers raising kids who themselves are not educated. When you educate a mother, you educate a nation. So I do think that those kinds of things must be prioritized, and I'm very heartened to hear that that has happened. The second thing that heartens me from this perspective is the fact that you've identified that it's not teenage pregnancy per se that's the difficulty. The difficulty arises much earlier. There are lots of new, I always want to say cultural issues, but they're not traditional values. They are new cultures that have emanated in this weird society that we have, which is, you know, the Western notions of liberation and what that means without necessarily the concomitant focus on responsibility. And so clearly your focus with regard to the issue of character building, values, responsibilities, all of those things are things that we would certainly support. It is a challenge, even those things. The point that was raised about teachers themselves having to be educated in as far as these things are concerned is a very telling issue in many schools. Having said that, I mean, I still hold firm to the belief that we have amongst ourselves very good teachers, teachers who are an example. Rather than a pestilence to our communities and so on. And it's that we need to build on. I don't think we must hold back. One of the big problems, I think, with tinkering with the curriculum has always been that you don't want to create uncertainty and all of those things that follow. And the first thing that people would ask is, if you do want to have this focus on values, is what about the teachers? You know, they themselves are some of the problems and so on. But actually, those are few and far between. We do have a core of people who are really, really wonderful members of society and who really help this country to be successful. And I don't think, and many of them are in public schools. Many of them are in public schools. I've seen some wonderful public schools. And I don't think that that they can't rise to this challenge. I do think that they're very up to this challenge. In fact, they're probably just the right people that we require to do. And all we need is to ensure that is supported and that the department becomes a little more focused, I think, particularly when it comes to life skills around these issues, that we start very early. If you start from your early learning phases, right up when you get to high school, you'll find most of these problems are actually problems that can be dealt with quite easily if you were to do that. But if you want to start at high school with a fundamental value like honesty and loyalty, when people have actually grown into certain habits and so on, then, you know, it's not going to work. So I do think that it's critical and it's absolutely urgent. That we get something going here. And I don't want you to leave because I have in my office some stuff that I want to give you around this issue. So while we are going to probably not, given that the documents are not here yet, proceed, we were going to members deal with our report to the visit that we, the visit that we undertook to the department in Pretoria the third draft of it, but Llewellyn says to me that his assistant has taken them back to the office and hasn't distributed them. So he's on his way back. What I suggest is we won't deal with it today. I'm going to suggest that members just hang around to receive the report as soon as he comes. He's on his way, am I right? Just take it with you. Study it at your own leisure, and then at our next meeting we'll find some time to go through it. I don't think we'll get very far in the little time that is left anyway. Lastly, let me just thank the committee on... I struggle with this. Is it women, children, and the disabled?
It's women, children, youth,
yes. And persons with disabilities. Persons with disabilities. I'll get it right one day. But thank you very much for gracing us with your presence. Always useful to bounce these issues off people who are actually dealing with the broader issues that the department has been raising around issues of inequalities with regards to gender relations, for example, and so on, and have some kind of in-depth knowledge on those issues. So thank you very much, and clearly if and when we do engage the department further on any of these issues, and of course on other related issues, one of the things that we will be talking to is access to education, and the issue of disabled learners will be very much a focus of that discussion. And when we do have those discussions, we will certainly invite you and hope that you will be able to attend. But thank you very much for attending to you and the committee chairperson. Members, we are stand adjourned. Please just wait for those drafts. Has he put them in the pigeonhole?
No, Chair, the last version we brought along to the meeting.
Okay. The one in the pigeonhole is the draft before this one. So you should just wait for this one and not work on that draft that you got in your pigeonhole, because that was the one after we had dealt with it in the last meeting. And then subsequently I looked at that draft and made further amendments. So the further amendments are not in that one, okay? Here are the reports. So what do you want to say?
We're just going to say if you have one that's dated at the top, 31 August, yesterday's date, That's the last one.
Is that 31 August? Then you should have the right one. But I see that thing's got a different cover page to yours now. I'm not sure. So just take this one in any case, right, and just check. Thank you, members, and we'll see you on Tuesday next week. Thank you very much.